September 27, 2011, is SWAT from Pedro Show.
Thank you.
Watt from Pedro Show. Not at Brother Matt's. I'm in my own pad. It's Tuesday. Last one in September. We started off with Dear Old Stockholm from John Coltrane and then Warp from Soako. And I'm very honored to share with you folks, guest for this edition, Watt from Pedro Show, Mr. Norton Wisdom, who braved the Hell Ride Traff, come down here and join us. Now, you know, Mr. Norton collaborated a lot together. Last time was 2 days ago here. In fact, in my Pedro town, it was the Tri-Arts Festival. Actually, it was more of a bi-art thing because I heard there was some feud between parties. We weren't connected with. The music was there. The dancing was there. But luckily, Mr. Norton here, he did come forth and represent the arts, even though those other people were boycotting or whatever, having their feud. Mr. Norton Wisdom is a painter, but not your typical painter. But I want to introduce him by him telling his story. So I want to know, where did you grow up, Norton?
Well, first, Watt, let me just say, thanks for your hospitality, and you know, this is taking place in San Pedro, this interview, and I'm always happy when I'm here, man.
Yeah, you can tell that he's not from here, because what'd you call the town?
San Pedro. That's how you know, man. Immediately his hair in the back of his neck goes, why did I invite this guy to... What am I doing now? I'm getting myself in trouble with my locals.
No, it's okay. But, yeah, I love usually wait for the end of the show to do those.
Okay, all right, man.
No,
anyway.
It's much my honor to have you aboard, because we've been working together since... It's got to be late '90s.
Yeah.
For a long, long time, and finally I get to have you on my show. So, where'd you grow up?
Where I grew up. I grew up all over L.A.
I just bounced
around Compton. I was born at L.A. General Hospital.
Yeah.
And then my dad was kind of a rock on tour and was hustling, and
what year was that? When you were born?
47, man.
Okay.
That's Whoa, I'm sorry to do that to your audience, man. I'm sure they're sitting back on their haunches now. 47? What 47? What's he talking 47?
Heinz. No, that's 57. I'm 1957.
Yeah. Well,
your pop was...
So anyway, so I bounced around. He was really one of the great artists in my life. He was art meant everything to him. But he was so mischievous that he was always getting in trouble. You know, he always owned nightclubs. He owned the Hollywood Riviera Club, which was a big nightclub in Palos Verdes, the north end of Palos Verdes.
Yeah, yeah.
Sinful
because
place.
They call that area for some reason the Hollywood Riviera.
Yeah, it was there was
even
a big.
It's between Palos Verdes and Torrance. There's nowhere near Hollywood.
Oh no, it's not at all. But it was a big. It looked like a castle. There's actually the staircases were still there. It's a historic monument. There's a little plaque right there at that crotch, and my dad realized that the money in the late 50s was in throwing teenage parties, wild teenage parties, which the folks of Palos Verdes didn't go for at all. And when the place caught on fire, they let it burn down to the ground. And this place was very big. It had two big dance auditoriums and five bars and a huge swimming pool and a motel in the shape of an old sort of Walt Disney cartoon castle. It was a hangout for all the, it was a watering hole for all the old Marine people in Hermosa and Redondo and in that area. You know, because that area
King
was...
King Harbor, I know they got... Dondo's got their own little arena there and stuff.
At that time, Hermosa and that area of South Bay was very much like San Pedro. It was working class. It wasn't doctors and lawyers and dentists. Everybody had an anchor tattoo and a pack of marbles rolled up in their T-shirt, and it was very down to earth, very
different than it is now.
Oh yeah, much different. But anyway, so that was That was
you were hanging around there as a kid.
When I was 8, that was my haunches. Then we lived on a boat. Then we lived on a boat for a couple of years in Wilmington. So I'm close. That's why maybe I have an affinity.
Wilmington's the back of the bay.
Yeah, yeah. I have
back of the harbor.
So anyway.
Actually, that's where the harbor started. Their motto is Heart of the Harbor.
Yeah.
Even though they get under the rug, little steps child to Long Beach and Pedro. Actually, it started in Wilmington.
Yeah,
this was a long time.
This would have been in.
This is even before your time. We're talking 1800s.
Oh yeah, that's before my time. Finally, something before my.
steamboats in our yard. No steamboats in our yard. We don't count. We don't have to count.
Watch for Pedro show. We heard first there was The Beginnings, Volume 2 by Wakine. Then Game of Pricks, something live from Guided by Voices. I got to see them. There's a trippy little park between Chinatown and Dodger Stadium. I think it's called Historical Park.
Yeah.
It's a strip of grass. You know this place?
No, I don't.
Well, there was a gig there a couple weeks ago, and I saw, I think it was the second to the last gig Bob told me of this certain version of Guided by Voices that was in the 90s. He also made an album with them, he told me. And he's got a new band, and we heard something from that called, they're called the Boston Spaceships, and we heard No Steamboats. And then finally, we heard Note to Self by Biblical Proof of UFOs. Back to the story of Norton Wisdom. So you got chucked off the back of a sailboat in Wimas. You guys didn't call it Wimas, did you?
I don't know what we called it. I was just, you know, I was 8 years old.
Because when I came from Virginia, and they put me in a junior high here after grade school called Dotson. And in those days, we had this thing called busing, where they would bring kids from different neighborhoods to go to school with each other. And we had cats from Wilmington. And, you know, they put it on the desk and write it. Wilma, I thought that was, you know, Barney and Fred.
Yeah. Right? It was the Flintstones. We were like living in the Flintstones.
Okay. But actually, it was a slang name for their town. They called it Wimas.
Yeah.
I found this out after about half a year that it isn't a group of ladies. I thought there was more than one of them because it was always with an S. Wilma's.
Yeah.
But it was Wimas. And there was a west side and there was an east side. And didn't get along too much, but I found out the divide line was Avalon Boulevard. But that was my first contact with Wilmington. We were kind of, even though we both share the harbor and we're both part of L.A. City, we were kind of separate. The way SoCal is, we're pretty balkanized as a whole area. People don't...
Yeah, very much so, I think.
Even though you're butt up against the next town, because there's not really space in between our towns here. If you fly over in a plane, it looks like one thing. But if you're on the ground, people only know.
Well, I think there's an identity thing. I think people like to have an identity. And it's it's the way we socialize is identifying with our town or our village or, it's a carryover from you know, a deep part of mankind is being part of a circular family and an extended family, but it has to be, you know, being had does have to have boundaries so that you know there is an us and them. I think that's a very part of man's sort of darker unconsciousness.
Yeah,
kind of weird. You know, but then I jumped from there. We lived in Malibu for a second. Our house there fell in the water during one of the
One off PCH. Stilts.
Yeah, one of those. One day I came home from school and it was in the water. Then we moved. My dad bought the old SC
but
Medical.
Like the water, because you're talking Riviera.
Yeah, all water. Well, not always.
Wilmington, Boo, all this water.
Yeah, water.
Because you ended up doing lifeguarding.
Right.
Was there
right.
a connection?
Very cloudy connection, right? I mean, I was always in the water, but
what was your first artistic experience?
My dad took me when I was 14 to Chouinard's, which was an old art school, very famous art school down by MacArthur Park in L.A.
Downtown, yeah.
And I was since I was 14, he couldn't get me into day classes, so he got me into a night class, which was full of housewives and bus drivers, and then this 14-year-old kid. And I'll tell you my first half hour of art school, the journey that I'm on.
Hold it. Let's play some more music. Okay, get. You're gonna tell me.
Okay, man. Thank you.
got a guy with hair on their arms serving the community bad pizza. I'm a talent scout observing the sounds like Mother Teresa. Come shake my hand when you want to meet Congress. You want them to meet you, otherwise you a creature feature. There's techniques with sideburns, humans you never learn. They're grown people on a first grade level. I gotta teach you the boss. The fall for the prophets, rapping to those earthy coaches and twisted Hebrew. Even with the cyclops out in the middle of their forehead, they know how to dodge and boost recharge. Act like they don't see you, but they eardrum wait like a passenger for that preview. Number one piece of parlor, everybody pulling your jewels and get that extra cheese. Number one piece of parlor, everybody put on your jewels and get that extra cheese. Number one piece of parlor, everybody put on your jewels and get that extra cheese. Who are they? Manufacturers, Hanover, I make them wait. Too nervous to bring my cup over, they slip too much. And you see his hard bottoms, bring your resume up a notch. And let my assistant look at your folder. They responding from a silly crowd, screaming to him with club soda. They all move bipolar, with leotards, they sit in yoga. But they play amateur style, slow motion poker. Too much cabaret, you can't tell them they that coca. Which one of them complaining? Are they a little mocha? Crybaby Grady in that black Mercedes. My walnuts on the stove, can't bake these. Don't forget the seasoning, please. Number one pizza parlor, everybody put on your jewels and get that extra cheese. Number one pizza parlor, everybody put on your jewels and get that extra cheese. Number one pizza parlor, everybody put on your jewels and get that extra cheese. Number one pizza parlor, everybody put on your jewels and get that extra cheese. I'ma stay cool because I don't wanna have to use the bathroom stools. You know my strategy right now. They won't accept the ghost and move. Many stupid try to put gas in their own.
want you to.
Thank you.
That was not rehearsed and they haven't listened to it. Thank you very much for Home and Garden with Tom Herman. One of the best guitar players ever to come out of Cleveland, Mr. Tom Herman. One of the greatest rhythm sections in rock and roll, Scott Krause and Tony Malone. One of the most genius noisemakers in the world, Robert Wheeler. And I'm some guy named Keith. Thank you very much.
Block from Pedro Show. Just heard Final Solution, something live from Home and Garden. That's a Paraubu show. From last month, a reunion of all those cats that lived in that apartment in Cleveland there that ended up in the band. And before that, something off Tom Herman's solo album. He was a guitar player, Paraubu, called Jack Something. Before that, we had City by the Water by Todd Congelier. Todd Conge was in the band after us when we worked the thing Sunday.
Yeah, he was great. They were great.
Underground
man.
Railroad to
yeah,
Candyland.
Yeah, I couldn't buy their CD fast enough. I was so inspired by their.
He's a great cat, man. He really is. He's put out over 100 records.
Whoa. He's not the trombone player.
No, he's a singer guitar.
Okay.
He's got several bands, and he's just a motivator. He ain't really Pedro. He's Torrance, but moved here in the 90s and just embraced the town. He's just a beautiful man. Before that, we had Extra Cheese by Cool Keith in 5471. We started off with Cat, Cat, Cat by Light, the Light Brothers. Okay, first half hour of art.
Okay, this channeled me for the rest of my life, this experience. And what it was, I was 14 years old, and there was this model, a very famous black lady who was mountainous. She I mean, everywhere you looked, there was these fabulous folds and volumes, and the art from the 60s, almost every artist from the Southern California drew her. Larry Graham, always when you see drawings of his, the famous Chicano sculptor, yeah, always would be drawing her. Anyway, so I'm 14 years old, and I'm looking at a nude woman, this big, fabulous sight, like landscape, and I was thinking to myself, wow, man, I can just stare at her and don't have to be embarrassed or morally, you know, ashamed, and don't have to turn away. I said, this art thing is cool, man.
Well, you got to draw her.
Well, half an hour, I didn't do anything but stared. And then I go, okay, all right, now down to business, Mike. And now down to business. So I took out my pencils and my paper. I got it all set up. And this sort of shaggy beatnik came in with his scrudgy little dog.
Yeah.
And I go, who's this guy, right? It's a half an hour, and I'm just about to put my pencil on the paper. And he goes, I want everybody to put away your drawing stuff. I want you to go home, and I want you to call Hiroshima and talk to somebody that saw the bomb.
And Hiroshima.
And so I'm thinking to myself.
You're talking about in Japan.
Yeah. And I'm thinking to myself, whoa, oh, that I can, I don't know. What did you, I can't call from my house. My mom would go through the ceiling. I'm going to have to call Hiroshima with quarters from a payphone. I wonder how many quarters that is. This is my mindscape, right? Well, he's talking about one of the most profound things about human empathy and the feeling for your fellow man and doing others how you want
to
be.
You guys to hear it from.
Yeah, from somebody. Yeah, he didn't want to just hear. You know what I mean? Just
imagine it.
Yeah, he wanted the real pathos, and so that was my first half hour of. I didn't even draw. He just kicked us out of the class.
To stare, and then we're given some trippy instructions.
And that guy turned out to be John Altoon, which was one of the really famous Southern California, first of all, abstract painters, and then in the 60s went into these crazy drawings, these sexual drawings. And he became, took me under his evil cape, his evil beatnik cape, and turned me on to Gorky and all these great Armenian artists who had come from New York to the West Coast and showed me how to use colors and the intensity of art and to put my feelings onto the page. And anyway, it was my mentor. And then he would take me to coffee houses. I was 14 and then 15, and we'd listen to jazz musicians at I don't know if you know Venice West. It was an old coffee house in Venice, crazy half the crowd was cross-dressers and the other half were total beatniks, and poetry and jazz. Red Holloway played there a bunch. Anyway, I would draw the whole time, and the artists would draw. There was no division between these different disciplines. You'd never think about art, drawing, painting, and jazz and music as being different. It was all just the same consciousness.
I think that's very healthy. We're at the end of the first hour of the September 27, 2011 edition of Pedro Show. We're going to continue with Mr. Norton Wisdom. So I'll tie it for hour two. September 27, 2011, it's the second hour of the Watt from Pedro Show. Watt from Pedro Show. We start out the second hour with some great stuff from Sergeant House. Played a bunch last show, and here's some more. Started with Galaxians by Boris, and Henry Don't Got Love by Le Bachurettes. Oh, they're going to open up for the Stooges in December at the Palladium. Then Frunk by Atabisi Shank. Got their drummer man Mick putting together this tour I leave out in 2 weeks. Announced the dates today. If you go to the Hoot page, MikeWatt.com. I'm bringing the third opera with Tom and Raoul to Europe. But first, day after tomorrow, we're going to once again join with Mr. Norton here. And it's going to be filmed. It's great. Well, but we'll get to that stuff later. And then we heard Last Smile for Jaron by Tara Melos. Not What It Is, But What It's Not by Bygones. Both those bands have Mr. Nick Reinhart. Incredible young guitarist. From Sacramento. Then If Gravity Lulls, I Can Hear the World Pant by Omar Rodriguez Lopez, incredible musician and composer, producer. Much respect for Omar. And finally, House of Hits by Zach Hill. I think he's Sacto too. I think he's drummer. In fact, I think he's the other guy with Nick there in Bygones, maybe. I don't know, my memory's bad, but your memory's good. So let's talk about those old days. We were talking about this serendipitous situations falling in that reinforce
what
you were after. Anyway, you knew you wanted to be an artist.
I wanted to be an artist, and I wanted to be a human being. I wanted to be, I wanted to be not part of the problem. I think that was what came out of the Beatniks.
Okay.
They didn't want to be part of the problem.
Yeah.
And so, and also the fact is that there was no barriers between disciplines,
it was still small enough where the big machine kept its hand off.
Yeah, they didn't have it in classroom. They didn't break it down into classroom.
It had been co-opted for marketing schemes and
exactly. So anyway, shortly after that, after 3 years with Altoon, I was 1966, and Haight Ashbury was going off, and I started hanging out up there, and then.
This 400 miles north, people.
Yeah, that, and then jumped in. Then by.
You might think California's all one town, but that
it's not. It's not.
And whole San Joaquin Valley in between.
In Northern California.
So, but you just decided, because people were talking in these coffee houses, hey, what about San Francisco?
Yeah, there was the talk that with Mario Salvio and the free speech movement, and it was a very big beatnik North Beach.
So what'd you do? Did you hitchhike or did you?
Yeah, I hitchhiked. Yeah, a lot of hitchhiking. Because who had a car that could make it 400 miles? We all bought our cars for $25, and that was,
those are beaters. Boy,
man, that's a rough one for a 400 mile trip.
Yeah.
But by 67, I was already in Berkeley. I was at UC Berkeley, and working.
Some people call it Cal.
Cal.
Mr. Hurst, I think.
Or Berserkly. Anyway, so I was playing water polo.
People's Park,
the Third World Strike, which was a big one, the Huey Newton and the Panthers.
That's right, Panthers.
You know, it was the Oakland was a big
East Bay.
Yeah, it was a big melting pot for revolutionaries at that time. Very serious people. So, playing water polo at Berkeley and painting,
because there's a swimming side because you were by the water.
I was a water guy, so I was, I was that was my life was water polo and
that is
and
a
art.
Tough sport. You got to be a strong motherfucker. Right? It gets a little vicious.
You got to tie your trunks. I'll tell you that. You got to tie your trunks if that means anything. Anybody can figure out what that could possibly mean. And even that doesn't do you any good.
It's tough. I've seen it.
The greatest coach. This guy, Pete Catino, he was from a left-wing fishing family from Monterey. He was the real salt of the earth. They were all communists. His family was all communists and Italian, fishermen. And it was. I'm sure there's a lot in this area down here in Pedro.
Was the capital when we were under Mexico.
Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's the old capital.
So that's where the coach was. So he was a great role model, father figure for me. Yeah. Altoon was the first one, then my water polo coach, Pete Catino, and then another. Then I started working for this guy Peter Volkas, who was a very famous ceramicist, and at this time he was doing bronze, and I became a foundry assistant for about 5 years until I got my MFA at Berkeley, I was working for Peter Volkes doing these big 30-foot high bronzes and stuff. And
like running furnaces.
Yeah, no, it was big kilns and furnaces and everything. Big stuff. 30 foot, you can imagine.
Industrial worker.
Yeah, no, it was big. It was big stuff. It was that's what it was all about.
Dangerous.
That's what it was all about, you know. Forklifts, we all, I mean, you can imagine, you definitely was part of the game with forklifts. So, so that was...
I didn't work a forklift, I worked pallet jack.
Yeah.
Clutch warehouse, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
The wheels in the back turn, so you got to know where you're going to end
up. Oh, yeah, yeah. I would never, they would fire me the first day. I'd probably, you know, I'd be definitely the bull in the china shop with one of those things, man. But, you know, forklifts are not much difference. They have the same steer, rear and steering.
That's what I'm saying. That's what's like their cousins.
Yeah, yeah.
They turn the back, so it's not like driving a car. Yeah, no, you got to know where you're going to end up. You got to plan it in your head.
You don't come to that job with you know, an understanding. Anyway, that's what happened there.
Wow, that's wild. So from drawing to water polo to bronze casting.
Yeah, I basically became a sculptor at that point. And I'll tell you a little bit about that story.
Hold on, let's play some music.
Okay, good.
I'm not afraid of the dark at night. I'm not afraid of your painted door. I'm just afraid of what might never be. To hold you tight.
Pedro show. We heard Didn't Intend to Hurt Him by Vortex Collisions. That's from Brighton, England. And Stinky Shit Slap by Spacecraft. I think that's from London, England. And Painted Nails by You, Yourself, and I. And that's a young man who knows Charlie Plimel, which is kind of my personal connection with the beat. He lived with Mr. Ginsberg and Mr. Cassidy up on Gough Street.
Yeah, Gough. There's a Gough in San Francisco.
Yeah, that's where they lived. And he wrote a great book called The Last of the Moccasins. It's an incredible book.
Yeah. Well, that's the crew, man.
Yeah. So I have a little bit of connect. I got to meet him maybe 4 years ago through Thurston at a poetry thing, and he writes me all the time. He wrote me a poem for me and Petra to interpret, and we're going to get to that. But let's get back to your art journey. Here you're cast in bronze.
Yeah. And
while the music was playing, people, Mr. Norton here was hitting me to this difference between craft and art, and actually there shouldn't be a difference, except, you know, the intent of the artist. But as far as dividing people up into highbrow and lowbrow, this is... Would you say that kids kept Southern California in the...
Well, you know, the highbrow critics that try to force an intellectual architecture over, you know, pour a smarty pants syrup on top of a work of art,
yeah,
so that only they can get the credit for interpreting it to the masses, have ruined Southern California and made the art quite stale and I think uncommitted. And in other words, when I look at most of the very expensive Southern California, I find it quite uncommitted, yeah, as far as the artist's intent and, yeah, and his joy of making it. It seems very flat to me, and I think that's mainly due because of the academia that has cheated the populace out of enjoying art. And we're talking about a struggle down here in San Pedro for usage of a warehouse,
yeah,
between craft and art, and there shouldn't be a struggle at all. It just blows my mind that everybody. I was saying that a beautiful Korean jar is as beautiful as any painting that you could see, and the Koreans weren't making it for function, you know what I mean? But when people get too crazy with their function, like they're just making ashtrays to sell it at art walks, then it, they're taking up space. They're taking up space. You know what I mean?
But you were in the foundry here learning from a man.
I was,
who poked holes in his clay pots so they couldn't hold water.
He punched them. He was a big guy from Montana. He was a Greek that lived in Montana. This big burly guy. And he was real macho, man. It was when you worked in the foundry, your shirts would be on fire, burning and stuff. I mean, it was a real thing, you know.
I believe it.
We'd work all night, and you know, I'd get to work at 2 a.m. We'd work until the dawn, until the sun came up. That was sort of our hours. It was really fun, exciting, kind of exciting time.
Wow.
And then while that was going on, my house in Berkeley was, we had this old three-story house, and it became sort of a hangout for musicians and artists. And at one time we took a head count. There were 27 people living in this in this house that I had rented. So it became.
What are we talking late 60s, early 70s?
Yeah, the late 60s and early 70s. Yeah. It was like, you know, Country Jones and Fish and the Grateful Dead crew, and I mean there was so many musicians in that Berkeley, San Francisco area, moving back and forth between the Haight and Berkeley, that the pad that I where I lived was quite a notorious crash pad.
Kind of a crux. A nexus.
So there was, you know, with my painting and performance art, I was doing a lot.
Oh, so you're doing this besides the foundry during the daytime?
Yeah, because I still had my own personal art.
Sure.
And my water polo. So it was, you know, the plate was kind of full. But in the house, it was a big, you know, goulash of the different forms of art. And, you know,
a lot of characters.
Yeah, you know, everybody was a character then. Believe me, everybody was a character.
A pantheon.
It was a pantheon.
Pageant.
So then there was a lot of drawing and painting with musicians. You know,
collaborate.
I mean, yeah, collaborate. Well, not really collaborating, but it was
all
happening in
each other.
Yeah, it was all happening together without anybody looking over their shoulder and going, "What is? Why is he doing that?" It just seemed all natural.
Scared.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody suspicious.
No
hustlers. No,
because I was my house, man.
Right. But there's 26 other cats.
Yeah.
You didn't have to mind them. It wasn't like herding cats.
You had to clear house once. It was like you know, on Mondays you can't park from 10 to noon.
That's like that thing.
You know what I mean? Just so we could get things straightened about. You know, it was that kind of thing, but. Then I came back to L.A. after I got my MFA.
We're at the end of the second hour. Let's hold that.
Good. Back to L.A.
Right. September 27, 2011. Second hour of the Wild Pedro Show. My guest artist, Norton Wisdom, back with more of his story. Hold tight for hour three. September 27, 2011. It's the third hour of the Wild Pedro Show.
Gone in a big forest.
for Pedro Show. Started off the third hour there with Shanny by Tatty Toes. I think they're from Scotland. And then we heard Snake in the Grass by the Black Angels. Maybe they're San Francisco. I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah.
But that was a psychedelic trip. Now, from this pad in East Bay up NorCal, you decided to come back to SoCal.
You know, what got me back is I was started to teach at Berkeley. I started to teach art, and I got a call in the middle of the winter from the head of the Zuma Beach lifeguard saying he had a full-time job for me. I left that night.
Zuma Beach people is Malibu for those that you don't live in Cali.
Yeah, it's northern Malibu.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was offered a full-time lifeguard job. And
out of
the blue. Well, I know I've worked hard. I mean, I was in line for it, but when it came,
why? Because of the water polo
connection? No, but because I'd become a lifeguard during the summers. I'd come home from Berkeley and lifeguard up in Malibu.
Oh, you said you already had boot connection.
Yeah, in '66 I had taken the test and became a lifeguard. So summers I'd summer here, and then winter at Berkeley. And when I was offered in I think '73 a full time job, and I was teaching at Berkeley, I didn't like teaching. It was kind of a babysitting thing,
You didn't see any students there that were you just a few years before. Did any of those teachers treat you like a babysitting when you were there at Berkeley?
No, not at all.
Because you lucked out with some good.
But they did. That's to say, it's a mixed bag.
What the times had changed?
No, well, they had changed after Altamont. The times had really changed.
Yeah.
It was like a curtain. Somebody pulled a curtain on the age of Aquarius.
Right.
I forgot the date of that, but that had really.
Just after Woodstock, right?
It was the end of an era. It was the end of the age of Aquarius.
It ended up with a lot of fighting and stuff. There's
murder.
A movie with the Rollins.
Yeah, there was a murder.
Stabbed to death.
Yeah, it was the Hell's Angels had redirected the entire consciousness.
The song "Give Me Shelter" is about that.
So
I drive through Altamont Pass when I'm going up to play the city.
Yeah,
that's where they got on them the first wind farm trips. And it's also
got
Livermore's there with the nuclear triggers.
Yeah, that's the paradox of Berkeley,
man.
It's
a mixed up trip.
You
know,
here's Berkeley, you know what I mean? It's supposed to be.
But anyway, so the school, you say that the things have changed.
Yeah, anyway, so the point, I wanted to be a lifeguard at the beach. I didn't want to be a teacher. I thought teaching would interfere with my creative energies.
Stifle?
Yeah, I think so. I noticed that most teachers don't paint, generally. You know what I mean? It takes. You know, unless you're a celebrity teacher that they just bring in because you're famous, right? And you don't really have to teach classes; they just want you on the roster.
Persona.
Yeah, they want you on the roster for prestige.
Yeah.
You know, it's like having a bunch of Nobel laureates at Berkeley. They had 11 when I was there, but none of them taught. I mean, I actually took a class from Teller, who was the guy that was the inventor
one
of
those bomb guys.
Yeah, he was the inventor of the hydrogen bomb. So. Me wearing a no war shirt for my 12 years, I'll probably be known as the guy who studied under Teller. That'll probably be my epitaph, right? Just when I die, it's like
well,
I want to be known as
the
man.
Right?
Yeah, I know.
It was the lottery.
I know, but I mean, you know how it is that you want your
you
epitaph to be about.
You were complicit.
Yeah, that you wanted to be about. He's a man of peace, and then
your hands are dirty and filthy and soiled.
You know, and then you die.
I remember his spiels.
Oh,
he was ridiculous.
He wanted to. To dredge bays, in commercial bays in Alaska with hydrogen bombs.
Yeah.
That was his theory on how to create a commercial bay.
Quick construction.
Yeah.
So you're now in Boo.
So and I come down to Boo, and I'd been in, but this time I'd been in a lot, I'd been accepted into a lot of galleries showing all around this country. And in galleries, but the Vietnam War had heated up so bad, it became so depressing that I no longer wanted to be part of the problem. So I withdrew from all my galleries and just decided to go into my studio and paint. So for like 8 years, I never left my studio, never showed anybody my art. I just stayed in my studio, which was on Adams, between Crenshaw and La Brea, which was called the Boulevard. I mean, the Adams is the hood, buddy.
Oh, I know.
It's
I worked
hood.
At 43rd and Crenshaw for an old lawyer.
Yeah.
Lamar Park.
Lamar Park, yeah.
And there was a club right near there called the Total Experience.
Mavericks. K-Day. There was Mavericks was
Mavericks
down
Mavericks and the Total, K-Day, the radio station.
KDAY.
And,
what was it?
This is early 80s when I'm working there,
yeah.
So this is a little at the tail end of what you're talking about. But Yeah, so that's where your art was.
So anyway, so yeah, that was where my studio was, and so I just stayed in my studio, and then I started. I hooked up with a German dealer who became very interested in my art at the end of this, like in 78, and I started showing in Germany, and through this dealer I got introduced to a lot of musicians, and one of my who became one of my best friends is Zam Johnson, who was the last touring drummer with Iron Butterfly. He'd been on the road for a year, and he just finally, when he got off the road, he just came into my studio and set up his drums, and we started bringing in other musicians.
You're painting.
Now, while I'm painting in my studio, yeah. Musicians started hanging out, and Eddie Snake Pit, a great horn player, would come there, and we were just down the street. It was on Adams. We were just down the street from the Parisian Room. So we go right from the studio to the Parisian Room.
They tore that down and put a post office on.
Well, what are you going to do, man?
That was like La Cienega and... right?
Yeah, it was La Cienega in Washington.
In Washington.
Yeah.
Because if you're going up on the west side, that's the most direct route from Pedro. You get off San Diego Freeway because it keeps taking you west. So if we want to go north, I used to pass that, and I seen a lot of gigs there.
Oh, you know, they all were there. All of them. That was the great...
These guys would come in, and you painting to their jamming.
Right. And this went on for a couple of years. We're really getting, you know, really becoming, it's kind of a scene.
But it's just in your...
Yeah, never left the studio. It was just a hang. No. And I had a show in Germany in 81, and I went there, and this time Reagan was going to save Germany by neutron bombing them.
Oh, yeah.
Kills all the people, but...
Saves the buildings.
Buildings are saved, right? And for some reason, the Germans were upset about this. There was a big protest in Bonn, like 300,000 people, which was, at that time, the biggest political march in history.
And Bonn was the capital of West Germany in those days.
Exactly. And that was the night of the march, was the night of my show, and that night I had dinner with Werner Herzog, who was a filmmaker and a great German sculptor, Nikolai Tregor, and we said that we just can't any longer sit by the sidelines and be artists in our little ivory towers. We have to get involved with, you know, these big issues.
Yeah.
You know, the studio no longer is the answer. We can no longer just, you know, like I was living in my studio and not doing anything.
Right, sequestered.
So we decided to paint on do a thing on the Berlin Wall. I paint on the Berlin Wall. This guy, Nicholas Tregor, was going to sculpt. He was going to ship out a little bas relief. And Werner Herzog was going to auction it off, right? And nobody thought in 81 the wall would ever come down. So we thought we'd make these deeds up and these rich people could buy these. I own part of the Berlin Wall. You know, here's my deed, right? We'd do this whole spoof on this Berlin Wall thing. And well, what happened was, before the dinner was over, Werner Herzog and I got in this insane argument. He said that he thought the height of American culture was this guy Dirty Harry, who was on cable TV, and he would have a trench coat and he would expose himself to women walking around New York and then interview him. And he thought that was brilliant, and I knew about this guy, but I thought he was kind of a jerk. But anyway, the fact that I didn't agree. I didn't agree with Werner. I didn't like say, "Oh, that guy's the greatest." I just kind of shrugged it off. He went nuts, right? Thought I was an idiot
for not acknowledging his good taste.
And that I was an idiot. I knew nothing about my people, my culture, right? I was really out of tune.
Oblivious.
And he had just come back from the Aspen Film Festival, where the film in Brazil. What was the film with Mick Jagger? Anyway, he was on the top of his game. They had considered Werner Herzog the guy that saved cinema because he was raw and front line and stuff. Anyway, while he was yelling at me, right, I was looking at him because he'd just come back from Aspen. I said, he had the big cowboy belt on, right? And I go, "Wow, that's a nice cowboy belt. That's a nice belt." And he goes, "Yes, it's Aspen. It's cowboy. It's a real thing. You should know about it." And on the belt buckle was an etching of a very famous German academic drawer from the 19th century, Heinrich Kleid, right? A real famous drawing, but it was German, right? On this cowboy thing, it was kind of a cowboy thing. It was two guys on a snail racing, like, you know. And I go, "Whoa." I go, "That's great, man." I go, "I love the fact they put a German," and he goes, "It's not German." He went, right, anyway. And he was trying to impress I'm not even going to go who he's trying to impress. Okay. So anyway, that fell apart. And so doing the Berlin Wall thing was off the table.
Yeah.
and I had a mural to do in the Black Forest in this castle. So I went up to the Black Forest, and when I got there, I went for a run in the Black Forest with this in, you know, it was very Wagnerian, toadstools.
Schutzwald.
It was up in
that's Black Forest in Germany.
Yeah. It was definitely a Black Forest. It was full of gremlins and very, you know, I mean, very Wagnerian.
Kobolds.
Big, big mushrooms and toadstools. But I had an epiphany at the end of this five-hour run that was, do what you do best, but do it at the Sistine Chapel.
Wow.
And so here I was given this riddle.
I gotta get to the Vatican.
Here was this riddle, right? Do what I do best, but do it at the Sistine Chapel. So
Michelangelo on his back.
I had to figure out what this meant.
And no paint on the ceiling.
Shall I drift on to this?
Let's play some music and we'll drift over.
All right.
Thank you.
a child from the 90s.
Never thought you'd have it.
Thank you.
Y for Pedro show. We heard some stuff that I play on. A brand new album from Brother Steve McKay called North Beach Jazz. We heard a tune called La Cuisine Charnel. Steve McKay, which is Carno Kitchen, his band from 40 years ago in Michigan. He got it with his drummer Marco, and they did a reunion thing with Dick Deluxe and invited myself. We did this in Sunset Beach. Then we heard Habit, which is something maybe 15 years ago. Ed Vedder singing, playing guitar, Dave Grohl on the drums, and me on the bass. We did a tour called the Ringspiel Tour. 16 years ago. And then finally, Effigy, which was I was invited to play a bass. Alan Woody had passed away, and Government Mule was working with different bass players, and I got to... Well, I like that flannel worn. Haynes told me, let's do some Creedence. So he put Ramble Tamble together with Effigy, and that's what we heard there. Now, back to the story.
Oh, God. All right, we're gonna move into this this riddle that I this epiphany I had in the Black Forest that said, do what you do best, but do it on the Sistine Chapel. Well, what I do best, I'm an abstract painter, right? That's what I do. I'm an abstract painter. I believe in, you know, that these unconscious images really have emotional connections with us.
And they can speak through symbol.
Yes. So that's what I do. And so I go, the Sistine Chapel, what does that mean, right? The Sistine Chapel, like we were just talking a few minutes ago, was the line between the pagan era and the Renaissance, because Michelangelo had a lot of the Greek gods were represented on the Last Judgment. And like you said, man, Renaissance was the humanism, and that Adam was as big as God, which is, you know, saying that the man now is the measure of all things. So this was the difference between the pagan era and the Renaissance, and also between good and evil, because hell... So it was a wall. This was the wall between all these different... And I left that night from the Black Forest and went to Berlin. Wall between good and evil.
Yeah.
It was the Renaissance wall was the Sistine Chapel between good and evil.
There's a parallel universe.
And then our wall between, you know, between the Soviet Union and the free market, right, between the authoritarian Stalinism and the free market, was the Berlin Wall.
Yeah.
So I think of it. I'm going to go to the Berlin Wall and do some abstract paintings on it. I'll just do what I do, right, and see what happens. No political agenda, you know, no Werner Herzog. That shit was that stuff was dead. That wasn't going to happen.
You unhitched that wagon.
And that wagon was definitely unhitched, Mike.
Broken wheels.
So I went to Berlin. I went that night, and then for the next 2 days, I tried to find a place in West Berlin where I could paint on the wall, where I could do my little abstract. And the Polizei kept chasing me away because the Berlin Wall was their cash cow.
Yeah.
This was what the symbol of Soviet oppression was, and they didn't want anybody to touch it. The rule was you don't paint on the wall, you don't touch it. This was 1981, right? With the 300,000 people still marching in Bonn. Reagan about to, you know, start the nuclear war, and me sitting there with my paints and brush looking for a place to do my little abstract painting, right? So this was the environment that was happening. And finally, I realized I wasn't going to be able to touch the wall, so I had to jump over the wall into East Germany in a place called Wedding, which is the Turkish area, so I wouldn't be bothered by the West German police. So I actually painted a mural which was 150 meters long on the east side of the Berlin Wall. And I had to stay there for 3 days, because once I jumped over the wall into East Germany, I couldn't come back onto the west side, because the police would have, you know, I'd left the country and the police would have arrested me, which they did. So I had to stay there. I stayed there for 3 days and painted this long mural. I had to paint only at night, because the day I didn't want the East Germans to see me. Because at that time I thought that, well, if they saw me, there would be a little chase, right? And I'd turn around and throw my Walkman at them, and they would salute me, and I'd say, see you at Disneyland, and that would be it, right? I figured that would be the consequences of this little jumping over the wall in East Germany. But I found out later that they had shot 500 people to death that year Right. And I was surrounded by self-shoot machine guns and minefields.
Yeah.
So in my naivete, right, I did this big long thing. And then the third day I left, and I was arrested by the West Berlin police for leaving the country without a visa, and then reentering it without a visa. I was flown out of Berlin by the police, and didn't get back in for 4 years. I kept trying to get back in, but I couldn't get permission because Berlin was not part of.
Oh, I know. I played there in those days.
Yeah.
Checkpoint Charlie.
How about SO36? How about SO36?
Yeah.
I played at
SO. Club. I played there with Black Flag.
Oh.
Minuteman and Black Flag. It was an old butcher.
It was the whole. It was, yeah.
They turned into a club or something.
Yeah, like the
slaughterhouse or something.
Kreuzberg
style.
They told
me that was the punk area.
Yeah.
Yeah, I played there.
That's famous. That was like the famous, famous club.
36.
Yeah.
Wow, so we share that.
Yeah.
Now look, you hook up with Nels Klein.
So then I came back after that, and we decided, Zam and I, the last drummer from the Iron Butterfly, decided we'd start playing the punk clubs. We couldn't do this in the studio anymore. The world was too crazy with the imminent possibility of a nuclear war. And everything falling apart. We thought that at this point we were going to take what was going on in my studio out to the punk club. So we formed a band called Panic, which was with Snake Pit. Eddie Snake Pit was an insane horn player. Yeah. And Zam on old Moog synthesizers. He had the old patch cords. Took him 45 minutes to plug in. And drums. And we went out on this. And I had my big screen then, which was a 12-foot by 8-foot plexiglass wall of light that I painted. And this is what we do, and we'd go into to Cathay de Grand. Yeah. I mean, it was a big deal, big operation. I brought all my stuff in a trailer, and we played all the clubs, Madame Wong's.
And what, Nels was on the bill?
No, but we started playing in the early 80s. We started playing this place called the Taurus Tavern, which was a dyke biker bar in Venice. And Nels used to come there when he was a kid. And check.
He grew up in Santa Monica.
He was in that area, so he'd come and check out our scene because we'd kind of got a reputation. What's his name from KCRW? Tom Schnabel was always giving us the horn. So you know we had quite a following in those days. So Nels would come and check out our scene. So that's before I even met him. And then later when he was doing the Monday night
New Music Monday,
New Music Monday,
the Crocodile.
I forced myself onto him, right? I used that my.
That's just on the west side on Pico.
Yeah, and so I forced myself into getting every hoisted myself onto stage with his Nels Klein trio.
Right.
And started performing there regularly.
And Michael.
Yeah, yeah. Don, was it Michael or Don?
Michael Preisner on the drums.
Oh, yeah, and who was the bass player?
Bob.
So anyway, so I kind of forced myself on Nels. And started painting.
Because that's our connection. Because when we, me and Nels start playing with Perkins in a band called Banyan, Nels suggests, I know this painter who can interpret gigs.
Yeah, and then they I'll tell you about my first gig with you guys. It was at that club on Pico. And I think there was that Arctic somebody was playing with opening, or Banyan was opening. For the Arctic, I forgot who it was, some cat. Anyway, I wore a dress because I thought this all you rock stars wore dresses, right? I just figured that's what the thing was. So I wore this dress, and I got to the club, and Perkins introduced me to Perkins, and Perkins looks at me. I got the dress, and he goes, "You're the painter. You're over there." Right? That was all he said, right? And I went, "Whoa, okay, right?" And so of course, I'm the only one in the dress, right? And this went on until we did the. All I know is Perkins looked at me, right? And he just said, "You know, I used to wear dresses." And then he goes, "I hate what I'm wearing." And at that point, it was probably the last time I ever wore a dress. I said, "I don't need to wear them anymore, man." I made my point. But anyway, then I got to travel with you, Mike. I got to go on the road with you, which was some of the great stuff, man, to get to hang with you and personally, get to watch your mind work.
September 27th edition of Watch for Peter Show 2011. Keep your powder dry.